Welcome to the Reformation Society. It's been going now for 16 years, meeting every Thursday night, and we tackle historical, contemporary, biblical issues. We are regularly trying to understand the times and to apply the Lordship across to all areas of life. It's vital that we understand what's going on in the world today. Tonight our guest speaker is Colonel Chris White, actually Colonel William White, Director, American Studies, U.S. Army War College, Carlisle Barracks in Pennsylvania. He is a U.S. Army Military Intelligence Officer and a Foreign Area Officer for Sub-Saharan Africa. That's where we are. And the current Director of African Studies at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Previously Senior Military Advisor to the U.S. Mission to the African Union. Would have had to deal with the kind of people we would not want to deal with off in our mansion. But maybe the military side, they're nicer if you didn't have to deal with the politicians. Colonel White has extensive experience across Europe, 3 tours in Germany, a tour in Italy, the Balkans, the Levant, Southeast Asia, Southwest Asia, further service in Africa with assignments in Tunisia, Liberia, Botswana, Malawi, Niger, Mauritania, Uganda and Ethiopia. His tours in Africa have included duty as senior defense representative and security assistance officer and attaché assignment. Colonel White is an author. He's extensive experience in defense and security, strategic, tactical, operations, intelligence, as well as signals, counterintelligence, security sector reform, peacekeeping, international development, and the health sector, including Ebola, HIV, AIDS, and all that. Defense acquisition, diplomacy, that's the sort of thing we wouldn't want to have to do. Probably got to be polite to people who don't deserve it.
Yes.
Program management and speaks 6 languages to varying degrees of proficiency. Does that include Afrikaans?
It does. But I always say, probably Afrikaans, nee, maar verstaan.
Yeah? Verstaan beter as a kind of. And French, I presume you better. You've been quite a few French speaking countries, so.
Yes. I speak French as well, yes.
So, welcome. Chris, pass on to all yours.
Thank you, Dr.
Start this here very quickly.
Well, good evening, folks, and thanks. It's a pleasure to be here once again at the Reformation Society. This is my 3rd trip to South Africa in the past 12 months. And each time I've been graciously and kindly invited to speak here at the Reformation Society, it is a distinct pleasure to get an opportunity to speak with you all. I hope that tonight's topic will be interesting. It will be extemporaneous. You see no notes, no PowerPoint slides. I'm going to talk about my views, which do not reflect the Reformation Society. Maybe some of them do. It's the folks involved with it, but these are my views and my analysis. A little more background. I am a historian and a political scientist, and so these topics are right in my wheelhouse, so to speak. So I'm happy to take questions as we go along. That's perfectly fine. Don't be shy. That'll probably make this much more interesting and interactive, okay? So unlike a politician, I'll try to answer your questions honestly. I'll do my best, all right? So for this topic, if you remember, those of you, some of you were here for the first one and the second one that I spoke, but the first time I talked about doing what's right, moral, and just in the face of injustice, thought that was an interesting topic. But tonight, we're talking about politics. There's going to be a lot of injustice in that, so I'll do my best to bring it to fruition, the story here. So 2024 is a very important year, obviously, for the United States and for South Africa. Both countries are holding national elections. For us, it's a really big deal in the United States. The question is, does the United States return to the ascendancy that it was on just a few years ago when Donald Trump was president? Or do we continue our path into oblivion, which is maybe a bit of hyperbole, but not entirely. In California, people can rob stores, and if it's under $1,000, they don't even bother arresting them. So you can steal $15,000 worth of goods and they just let you go. In Memphis, Tennessee, the crime has gotten so bad because the prosecutor won't even prosecute people based on their stealing things that they're going to neighboring counties. But they're quickly discovering that the police in neighboring counties don't put up with that nonsense. You may have heard a song in America recently by a country singer called Jason Aldean.
Yes.
Try that in a small town.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what they tried. They tried it in a small town. That might fly in a city, but it don't work in a small town. Anyway, so the sheriff in a nearby in the county, they had the video and they went and arrested these people, much to their chagrin, because they've been stealing at will in Memphis and with no consequences. So the rule of law is breaking down in America because of a number of things. And 2024 is probably an inflection point for our society and what's going to happen. In 2024, every member of the House of Representatives, 435 congressmen and congresswomen, will face re-election as they do every 2 years. I don't know the exact number of senators offhand, but every 2 years, about one-third of our senators of the 100 face re-election. In Pennsylvania, we have Bob Casey, a Democrat, who's leaving the Senate, and the seat is up for election. So Democrats and Republicans are now looking at filing. And I guess I'll let a little secret out of the bag here right now. I'm seriously considering running for the United States Senate. I don't think I have a snowball's chance of getting elected, but I do want to raise issues about the woke nonsense going on in America and bring attention to people lying about America's history and just try to get that stuff on the table. So I need 2,000 signatures from registered voters and $200. I can manage the $200. I don't know if I can manage the 2,000 signatures, but we'll see.
Can they be from any state?
What's that?
Can they be from any state?
No, it must be registered voters in the state that I'm going to run.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
But, I mean, we have 9 million voters, so I should be able to pull that off. The question is, I'll tell you up front that I could never run as a Democrat. Those people have lost their minds. I would run as a Republican, but I'm not particularly fond of the Republican Party, which might work against me. I think they know that. So I have a habit of calling the Republicans in Congress the rhinos, Republicans in name only, and I call the Republicans and Democrats the Uniparty because they work in conjunction to destroy my country, burying us in debt, passing laws that make no sense from my perspective. Again, these are my views. That's something I'm just letting out here. I may be doing that. Short of that, there's a very strong possibility if I don't run for the U.S. Senate, I will be running for higher office in Pennsylvania. I'm currently a judge of elections, and the reason I'm a judge of elections is that the shenanigans that happened previously, or at least the alleged shenanigans that happened in what I call the choosing of 2020, so that I don't get banned on YouTube, it's the choosing of 2020, I was not comfortable with where things were at, so I ran a write-in campaign for judge of elections in my precinct, and I won that election, and I've now served for 4 different elections. We do 2 per year, so we have the party's primary in the spring, and then in the fall we have the general election. So I'm a judge of elections, so I know very well how the system works in Pennsylvania with the votes and whether there's a possibility for cheating or not. And at least in-person voting, there's very little, almost zero chance for cheating in my experience. So that has restored some confidence in me as far as our elections in Pennsylvania from that aspect. Also, of course, 2024 is a big year for South Africa, but only if you all go out and vote.
Yep.
Only if you vote. Black, white, and brown South Africans, I constantly hear, well, my vote doesn't matter. Before I talk more about the elections next year, I want to reflect back on 2021. For the municipal elections in 2021, some of you, I think, actually watched my content and know that I interviewed 40 candidates for office in South Africa in the 3 months prior to the election. So basically more than one a day, some days, from 8 different political parties. No, not the ANC and not the EFF. I won't interview the EFF. I don't interview race hustlers. I would interview the ANC, but they don't answer the phone because they feel they're comfortable. They don't have to. But 8 parties, and I interviewed the leaders of 6 of those parties. And I tried to exhort and encourage South Africans to go to the poll because your vote matters. The story I told folks from 2020 to 2021, election November 2021, is that if the Democratic Alliance had retained the same number of voters in 2021 that they received, or excuse me, 2016, that they received in 2011, they would have run Nelson Mandela Bay outright. There never would have been a coalition in Nelson Mandela Bay, and we wouldn't have seen the shenanigans of coalitions falling apart. The DA would have ruled it from 2016 to 2021 without any interference. But they lost 9,000 of their voters, and they didn't reach a majority, so they had to form a coalition, and we saw what happened in Nelson Mandela Bay with Athol Trollope, the constant fighting to keep the coalition together. So that's the story I told. But nobody listened. People didn't go vote. 31% of South Africans went to vote. So that's kind of the standard norm. Now, 2024, I'm going to mention 2021's municipal election because the story I told you was 100% accurate, and let me explain why. In 2021, the EFF lost 2% of its voters from the previous municipal election. The ANC lost 31% of its voters, mostly because of the insurrection in KwaZulu-Natal, where a lot of ANC voters simply stayed home. They didn't go to the polls. But the DA lost 37% of its voters. They went from 4 million to 4,000 voters to 2.5 million. Now imagine if they retained those other 1.5 million voters across South Africa in those municipalities. They wouldn't have lost municipalities in Western Cape. But the real story here is 2 parties. The Inkatha Freedom Party gained 2% more voters, just 2%. But does anybody know how many municipalities Inkatha controlled before that election? I want to take a guess. I'm not trying to put you on the spot. Anybody know?
9, 1, 2.
Good guesses. 8. Not a lot. In KwaZulu-Natal, they controlled 8 municipalities. after the elections, either through an outright majority, a majority coalition, or a minority coalition. Anyone want to take a guess at how many they control? From 8 to what? Anybody?
34.
How many?
34.
That's a good guess, actually. It's close. It was 26. They went from 8 to 26. And they only gained 2% voters. Now, why did they jump from 8 to 26? Because ANC voters stayed home. So every vote that they got counted that much more. So when people say their vote doesn't matter, that's hogwash. Your vote does matter. You have to vote. And vote for your conscience, whoever that is. I hope it's not the EFF, but vote for your conscience. But go vote. It makes a difference. Whether you vote for the African Christian Democratic Party, the Freedom Front Plus, the DA, Action SA, the Cape Color Congress, whoever you vote for, it makes a difference. It really does. So I think that's important to mention because just 2% votes. Now, they only control 23 today because in some of those coalitions, the EFF joined them, and then the EFF backed out of the coalition, so they lost control of 3 municipalities. But the Inkatha Freedom Party still controls 23 municipalities in KZN. Now, why does that matter? Because in South Africa, your politics are different than our politics. In South Africa, what you get from municipalities is very different. My municipality does not do my rubbish removal. I pay a private vendor for that, and they pick it up and take it away. And they're always there, or I go to someone else. So my electricity is not provided by my municipality. It's provided by a private company. So it's very different for us. So if I vote for a town councilman, it's not because I want the rubbish removed or I want the streets repaired. They do that. But it's for very different reasons than you do it here. But in South Africa, the lights, the local police, the rubbish, all these services are provided by a municipality, correct? All right. So if you're an opposition party, you want to prove to voters that you can make a difference, the municipal elections matter. The Inkatha Freedom Party has a golden opportunity to prove, and they've had it for a year, over the next year, to prove to voters, particularly in KwaZulu-Natal, that they can make a difference for you and hopefully convince them to vote for their standard in 2024. And that's why municipal elections matter so much. So I was at the national convention in O.R. Tambo at Kempton Park. Does anybody know about Emperor's Palace and the National Convention? Could I see a show of hands? Raise your hand. Do you know that that happened? 1, 2. Okay. That confirms exactly what I've been concerned about. Okay. So the National Convention was a gathering of opposition parties to form a pre-election coalition. You've heard of it. Okay. All right, you probably hadn't heard that term then. Okay.
See, yeah, I followed this thing on News 24 in which the parties came together to form this pact.
Yes. Okay. So you know what I'm talking about. Just the term was wrong. So these parties came together. There were 7 of them. Only a few large parties, but 7 parties total. And the idea is to form a coalition before the election. Not wait until after the election, try to cobble one together. Now that's important because it could be historic. I'm not saying it is, but it could be historic in the standpoint that it might be one of the most significant political developments in South Africa since the CODESA Convention, the Convention for Democratic South Africa, which set the stage for where we're at today back in the early 1990s, if they're successful. They agreed on a vision statement of what these parties hope to achieve. They agreed on an objective, which is to unseat the ANC and to keep the EFF out of government. That's their stated objective, these 7 parties. They also invited any other party that agrees with their standards and goals to join them. So the tent is open for others to join, provided they agree to the vision and they came up with key tenets of what they're all about. Governance, they're talking about reducing the size of cabinet, they're going to have lifestyle audits for all senior leaders in any position, and the end of cater deployment and things like that. So on paper, it looks wonderful, but if you ever tried to herd cats, it doesn't always work so well. So we will see if they're successful. But those parties were the Democratic Alliance, the Inkatha Freedom Party, the Freedom Front Plus, Action SA, the Spectrum National Party, Sanko, and the United Independent Movement with Neil DeBeer. So those 7 parties have all agreed. They've also agreed on power sharing before an election. If they get power, they've already agreed on how it will be done. For instance, no party will have control of the presidency and of the legislature. The top 2 parties for vote getting will get one or the other. So they've already agreed on this. And they basically, it's more than likely the Democratic Alliance would be the biggest vote getter amongst these opposition parties. So they basically said the person who's responsible for the business of the government will go to the top vote getter. So it's probably going to be the Democratic Alliance. And if that were now, I would guess it would be John Steenhuisen because he's the leader of the party. But anyway, so they agreed to all these things. It could be very historic. Can't promise it will be. Maybe it won't be. And the tent is open for others. So there are other parties that may or may not join, like the UDM under Bantu Holomisa. The African Christian Democratic Party under Kenneth Mishwe, maybe COPE under Terry Lakota, I don't know. But while this is happening, of course, the African National Congress is a little bit scared, not of that coalition, but of the fact that their popularity is waning, and it is really waning. Yes, you have a question.
We need to remember that in 2006, Cape Town was run by a minority coalition
by the ANC.
And it worked. It was actually the precursor to what we see now with the DA having outright control. But it was control started through one of these same coalitions that's being negotiated now. It actually happened in Cape Town in 2006.
Well, that's actually been pointed out that they've learned some lessons from the coalitions, but particularly from the coalitions that have collapsed, like the one in Port Elizabeth, in Shwane, and in Johannesburg, that it's unseated the mayor there. So they've learned from those, they've learned lessons, they say. There's potential here. Now, it'll be incumbent on each of these parties to live up to the things they've agreed to. But they've made promises, they made it clear. Now, one stipulation for this, for a few of the smaller parties, was that they would not enter this agreement unless the Democratic Alliance promised it would not enter an alliance with the African National Congress. The Democratic Alliance and John Steenhuisen signed a piece of paper saying they wouldn't do that. So, if they do join alliance with the ANC, then you can hold that over them. But the election coming up next year in South Africa, I think, is fascinating. And I think it holds potential for a change. Of course, that depends on whether the ANC actually gives up the reins of power if they lose. On November 1st of 2021, for the municipal elections, as I covered them, I projected that the ANC would get no more than 42% of the popular vote in 2024. I'm sticking to that figure. I see no reason to change it. They're wildly unpopular in a lot of places, and they get a lot of votes just because a lot of South Africans just don't know better. I interviewed a lady who's a Tswana speaker in Northwest Province this week, a grandmother who's lived in an informal settlement, Rifle, south of Zeerust, for 30 years. There's no paved streets, there's no sewage, there's no running water, they use JoJo's for water, there's nothing. Now, for me, I'm a teach a man to fish kind of guy, you know, and not just hand out the fish. So if I lived there, I'm just saying I would have picked up and moved stakes and gone somewhere else by now. There's no jobs, there's nothing. They have no transport. They used to have a mobile clinic. The clinic just stopped because the money's gone now. And that city is under administration because it's been so poorly run by the ANC. So I'm not trying to say that the situation these people live in is not entirely the fault of the ruling party. But under the system you have, the municipality is responsible for delivering services. It's been 30 years. They haven't paved the roads. They haven't put sewage out there. They haven't put proper electricity. They do have electricity, but it's kind of jerry-rigged. The point here is that I asked the lady, I said, do you mind if I ask you, do you vote? And if so, would you share with me whom you vote for? Now, I knew the answer, but I asked, and she was forthcoming and honest. She says, of course I vote. It's my duty to vote. And I said, whom do you vote for? The ANC, because I'm supposed to. And that's why the ANC gets as many votes as they do. A lot of people in South Africa, they feel they're supposed to. They believe the myth that the ANC liberated South Africa, which is pure fiction. It's nonsense. The ANC was not even a factor from 1962 after Rivonia trials until 1985 when the Soweto uprising took place. And that whole time, most people didn't even know the ANC existed. They were in exile and not having much of an impact here. So the myth of ANC liberation and playing a big struggle excludes Steve Biko and the Black Consciousness Movement, excludes Helen Suzman, and the Black Sash Movement and the student protests and all the other things that occurred, and ignores the most important reason why apartheid ended, is that the argument for maintaining the existing order disappeared. The Red Menace at least appeared to have disappeared. Communism was dead. Little do we know, it came back with a vengeance, yes? Even in my country, it's made a comeback, which is shocking. But the argument for continuing, the majority of voters who voted said it was time to change. So it wasn't because of the ANC. They seemed to like that logic, and they convinced millions of South Africans that it's their obligation and duty to vote for them, despite the fact that they steal trillions of rand, that they destroy the infrastructure, they're destroying the social fabric of this country, and their laws are more racist than the national parties, excluding people based on skin color. And now they have intruded into the private sector with the Employment Equity Act, which is directing private businesses to hire people based on gender and sex, or gender and skin pigmentation. It's ludicrous. And as the Democratic Alliance analysis has pointed out, at least 642,000 minority South Africans would lose their jobs. That's a shocking figure. And in their place would be people hired not based on competence necessarily, but based simply on skin pigmentation. That's basically racism. I don't know how you describe it any different. So 2024 is an important year for South Africans, and I hope that you all go to the polls and vote your conscience for whomever you think is the right party, and hopefully we'll see change. But I can't say that's the case for sure. I'll turn now a little bit to our elections. Our elections are quite important for us as well. Donald Trump is running in a Republican ticket, and they had a debate last night. And there were standards for qualifying for it. You had to have so many percentage points in a poll. You had to meet different conditions. So I believe there were 8 candidates who stood in the debate last night. But Donald Trump wasn't one of them. And people have asked me, why wasn't Trump there? I said, well, 2 reasons. Number one, why would Trump go? If you take all the other Republicans competing against him, put all their poll numbers together, he still beats him by 25 points. He's wildly popular. So there's nothing for him to gain. Just like Biden hiding in his basement in the last election, there was nothing for him to gain by campaigning, because if he went to campaign trail, people would see how incompetent he was, and he wouldn't get elected. So Trump is competent, but there's nothing to gain by going to it. And more importantly, I think for American voters, it was probably best that Trump wasn't there, because some of the other candidates are just vile human beings who are attacking Trump just so they get attention, like Chris Christie from New Jersey, who was the least popular governor in U.S. history with an 8% approval rating when he left office.
Didn't Trump employ him at one stage?
He brought him into his sphere briefly. And then it was also around the time of the last choosing. So Chris Christie has betrayed him. And then also we've got from South Carolina, Nikki Haley, who was the ambassador to the United Nations under Trump and said she would never run against her former boss. Well, that proved to be dishonest. She's running against him. So for the debates last night, from my point of view, if Trump had been there, it would just put it a sideshow. There would have been nothing substantive. At least Republican voters get to listen to the candidates that were there and evaluate whether that's a person for me or not, or I'm going to go to Trump, or I'm going to vote something else. So that's kind of where that's at. As far as the election next year, I can't honestly project who's going to win. My prediction last time was wrong, according to the government. The states have said that someone else won, and I said that Trump would win. Clearly, I was right about the vote totals, though. I said we get over 70 million. He got 75 million, but apparently he didn't win. That's what we're told. So this time I really can't predict it, because for our political system, it's up to the legislatures in each of the states to determine the laws on how elections are conducted. And states do it very differently. So I really can't predict who's going to win. All things being equal, Trump is incredibly popular, not just with Republicans, but with Americans in general, particularly with all the attacks on him of late. People can see through the plain political nonsense that's going on that's clearly directed at Trump to keep him from getting in office. If you notice the latest indictment, he's charged with things that are not even crimes. How do you get an indictment to prosecute someone when they haven't committed a crime? Well, in Donald Trump's case, you can do it. He is accused of lying. That's right, he claims he won the last time, but so did Hillary Clinton. So did Stacey Abrams in Georgia. And so did Al Gore in 2000. But nobody's indicting them. He's also accused with trying to take advantage of the insurrection, the so-called insurrection of January 6th. The problem, of course, is we have recordings of Donald Trump that afternoon telling people to obey law enforcement, do not enter the Capitol building and leave. So I'm not sure how they're going to prosecute him for a crime he didn't commit. But that's what's happening with Trump. And it's one thing after another, and they just keep making it more ridiculous. But those weren't even crimes, so I don't know what's going to happen there. From my perspective, my analysis is that this is an intentional effort to keep him from campaigning and to tarnish his reputation so that people won't vote for him. But it is backfiring, because Trump is becoming ever more popular with Republicans, with some independents, and even some Democratic voters who have said, "Chinook is chinook." They've had enough. They've had enough. So I can't predict what's going to happen. I can tell you what I hope for. I hope that if I run for office, I get elected, so I can make a difference if I do run for office, and especially if I run for the Senate. That would be incredible. But I also hope that we return some sense of normalcy in America next year, because my country cannot continue to endure this nonsense. The utter nonsense is taking place in our country, where people just say that there's something they're not. They deny biology. And every time somebody's feelings are hurt, it's racism, when it's not. It's just your feelings are hurt. There's a distinction between bigotry and racism, and usually it's neither one of those. It's just someone who just didn't like the answer, so they just start pointing fingers. We can't afford this, and we need politicians that stop being cowards. Let me give an example of something I think is cowardly. So the United States ended the legal institution of slavery on the 6th of December, 1865. That's when the states that weren't in rebellion passed the 13th Amendment. So that changed our Constitution, ended legal slavery. So that's the date we should celebrate the end of slavery. Before that, slavery was still legal in America. But in June of 1865, a Union general arrived in Texas as the Union Army advanced, and he spoke to former slaves and told them, you're free now, because the president signed the Emancipation Proclamation 3 years ago, and any place that's under control of the Union Army, if there are slaves there, they're now free. And so the people where he was at were free. But the reality is that 90% of people enslaved in Texas were still enslaved because the Confederates still controlled most of Texas. The cowardly Congress, in a vote of 414 to like 13, others abstained, out of 435 last year, or earlier this year, it was last year, I think maybe the earliest year, voted to approve Juneteenth, June 19th, as a national holiday for the end of slavery. Well, that's the date that this Union general is in Texas. It's not when slavery ended. But politicians, afraid of backlash, afraid of being called racist and ignorant of American history, have altered our history now. So I'm just personally kind of tired of that nonsense. I have no problem with celebrating a national holiday at the end of slavery. We're one of the first countries in the world to end the institution of slavery. I think that's something to be proud of, at least officially. Slavery continues to this day, as we know, especially sexual slavery. It's horrific around the world. If you've seen the movie, is it The Sound of Freedom? What's the same one, Doctor? It is The Sound of Freedom. That's the one that's out now. You'll know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm glad that some attention is coming to this topic. So that's kind of where I stand on what's happening with the election next year. We also, as I said, senators will be elected, and that's particularly important because the balance in the Senate is razor thin. Republicans would need to capture a couple seats to take control of the Senate, and they have control of the House now, but we'll see what happens in this November, next November, because that will affect the House as well. There's potential the Republicans could gain all three back, but I'm reasonably confident they can win the Senate and retain the House, but I'm not sure about the White House because I just don't know how it's going to go. On the Democratic side, President Biden is running for re-election. One significant thing about that, Susan Rice, who was in the Clinton administration and the Obama administration, very close to the Obamas, was in his White House until he announced he was running for re-election. She resigned. That's kind of an indicator to me. The Obamas are probably not happy that Joe Biden has decided to stroke his ego and run again. So Biden will be running again in 2024. And for him, I suppose that means he'll be having chocolate chip ice cream a lot. You know, that's probably his campaign plan. But the Democrats also have some other candidates. Robert Kennedy Jr., the son of Bobby Kennedy, a former attorney general, was assassinated in the 1960s. He is running. And the press and the social media are censoring him heavily. They're lying about him. He's a Democrat. It's not a person I traditionally vote for, but he does have some positions that make sense to me. And the behavior of the media and of the public in general towards him are just atrocious because they don't like what he has to say, especially because he's a Democrat. And there are a few other contenders in the Democratic Party who are looking to step in, one of whom is probably Gavin Newsom. I call him Gruesome Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, the man who single-handedly is destroying the Golden State. And he is probably going to try to run for president as well. And he is just another talking head that knows very little, but there's a very real possibility because he's photogenic and he's from California that if he were to enter the race, it might make a difference. That's kind of where we're at. So as far as predictions in South Africa, if that coalition I talked about can be true to what they say, and if they do what they promise to campaign not against each other, but for office, and you vote for the ACT, well, they're not ACT, for the DA or the Cotta Freedom Party, if you vote for them and then they bring the resource together and are able to unseat the ANC, then there's a real potential for change in South Africa. But there's also potential that you could wind up with an Italian government. After the Second World War, the Italian government collapsed probably 70 times because of coalitions. They could never get a majority coalition that would hold together. So there's a possibility of fractious politics there. There is one outlier. Now, the Democratic Alliance has signed that agreement saying they will not do it. Some people don't believe that. I don't know. I'll take them at their word for the moment. But a lot of people fear the possibility that the sliding ANC, needing a coalition partner, will team up with the Democratic Alliance. Now, if that happens, it's going to be Zimbabwe light, in my view. So the DA would take over like finance and a few important ministries like that, which will help keep the country limping along. And the ANC will control all the state apparatus for security and intelligence, things like that. And it will continue South Africa's slow march to oblivion. That's my view if that happens. The DA says they're not going to do it, but I think a lot of people genuinely fear it's going to happen. Now, another coalition a lot of people are terrified of and talk about a lot is if the ANC needs support and they turn to the Economic Freedom Fighters. Now, let me talk about that. A lot of people think the Economic Freedom Fighters are a party that's on the rise. I'm going to tell you they're not. Don't be misled by 92,000, 100,000 people showing up at FMB Stadium. Remember a few months ago, the EFF did a national shutdown? I call that the national letdown. I had more viewers on my nighttime Night Owls program than they had show up in Pretoria that day. So that shows the true strength of that party. It's one thing to offer T-shirts and a free rock show or your music show to come to a stadium and watch it and get people to show up there. It's quite another to get people to go to the polls. So don't be misled. I'm saying that's misleading. If you believe they're powerful, that's fine, but they're not. I've always said, and I stick by this position, the EFF is a maximum 15% party in a national poll, national election. They'll never get more than 15%. There aren't that many stupid South Africans, I'll tell you that. I know a lot of South Africans. There aren't that many stupid people in this country. They'll never get more than 15%. So they're not the power block they think they are or that a lot of people in the media claim they are. Of course, some of those people in the media are accused of taking money from the EFF to write positive stories about them. I have no evidence of that, so I'm not targeting anyone. No. Yes?
And do you think that if we ignore the EFF, they will go away?
No, the EFF won't go away. But what needs to happen is they need to be marginalized politically. And the way to marginalize them politically is uniting opposition parties to get power and then to fix the things that are going wrong in South Africa. Folks, over half your population was born after apartheid was over. They know nothing but ANC rule except here in the Western Cape and briefly in KZN where the Inkatha Freedom Party led the first election. That's it. The rest of the country only knows ANC rule. They don't know anything different. Here's the thing about the EFF. As long as Cyril Ramaphosa runs the ANC, I almost guarantee you, I'll eat my words if I'm wrong, but I almost guarantee you, unless it's a desperation thing, that the ANC will not form a coalition with the EFF. They'll find some other way. If they're close enough, they'll find another way. They'll drag the PA in or COPE or somebody. But Cyril Ramaphosa detests Julius Malema with a passion that's reserved for, well, I won't say the word, but anyway. He does not like him. And if he gets unseated as leader of the ANC, it's a new ballgame. The ANC might do it. But I think it's unlikely. The coalition that people are terrified of, ANC, EFF, I think it's unlikely. I think it's more likely to see the DA, Renig, and actually ally with the ANC for power, hoping they could save South Africa. At least that would be their argument. But whatever happens, the bottom line is that you all need to go to the polls. You need to vote. If you're eligible to vote, please go vote. Vote for your conscience. I'm not going to tell you should vote for. That's between you and God. You know, you pull that lever for whomever, or make that mark for who you think is right. But you got to go vote. And it's the same for Americans. They've got to go vote. None of this belly aching. My vote doesn't matter. It doesn't make a difference. You got to go vote. Hopefully it will make a difference. So that's kind of where we're at on both those situations. That's about 30 minutes. I'll start taking some questions here. Yes, sir?
What's your take on the
PA? On the Patriotic Alliance. Fascinating. Fascinating, but I don't know if I should say publicly what I really feel here. But okay, well, there's that. There's some interesting things coming from Gate McKenzie. You know, he went to Aranya to investigate Aranya, and he said Aranya has some good ideas. But then he went on with Dali and Pofu, and Dali and Pofu tried to egg him on, and he basically called the Aranya racist. And then Gate McKenzie agreed with him. So I would like to question him and say, how are they racist? Are the Zulu racist because white folks don't live in the Inganyama Trust? No, because it's for Zulu. If you're an Afrikaans speaker and you're a Dutch Calvinist and you agree to the terms, you can settle there. It doesn't matter what your skin color is. I am not an Afrikaner. I don't speak Afrikaans as a first language, so I'm not eligible to live there. But guess what? I'm kind of pink. So he's also, I haven't confirmed this, but someone told me that he just went to Israel. That Gate McKenzie went to Israel. I don't know. They said he went to Israel and that he said some things about that which were interesting. He would not join a coalition unless South Africa's governing government would agree to recognizing Jerusalem as the capital.
Yes.
Is that true?
Well,
yeah, I don't know if it's true or not, but if he said that, that's very interesting. So let me finish this question. So my view on the Patriotic Alliance, a lot of analysts in South Africa are talking about watch out for the PA. They're going to be powerful because they won a few by-elections. I don't know. I don't see that. Maybe. But I don't know that I do or do not trust Gate McKenzie and the Patriotic Alliance. He was mayor briefly, and he accomplished some things he set out to do, but he also didn't accomplish some other things. So I think it's kind of an unknown, and we'll see. But if you think they're the right people for you to vote for, then that's who you should vote for. I'm not saying you do. I'm just saying to the audience in general. Did I answer your question, sir? Back here.
As a political-minded person, I do my own research on the political parties and the politicians and what they stand for. And my understanding is that he speaks sense. I mean, he says if the patriotic governs South Africa, we're going to put God back in schools, which is what we actually need here. And we will bring the death penalty back to South Africa and things like that. So he does speak sense. But the thing is, he can't be trusted. I mean, then behind closed doors, he says something completely different, you know, and...
Well, and that's why it's an unknown to me, because I've seen both sides of that coin. So I'm not saying for or against him. I'm just saying that's what I'm observing right now. So I'm not entirely comfortable. Dr. Hammond, you had a question.
It's interesting to hear your opinions about Robert F. Kennedy Jr., because he's such an interesting mainstream Democrat who is cutting across what they're doing. But what is America's law concerning presidential candidates? Is the Secret Service not meant to provide protection for candidates for presidential elections? Because Robert F. Kennedy is polling very high on the Democrat side, and he's been given no Secret Service protection, even though apparently a whole lot of others who are polling in single digits are. Is there prejudice against Robert F. Kennedy? Is it even legal? How can the Secret Service not provide protection for a candidate whose father and uncle were assassinated and who gets death threats as well? I mean, isn't there a real danger in American politics that some popular candidate gets assassinated? It happened before in 68 with Robert Kennedy. His dad. So,
and his uncle.
Do you have an opinion about this?
I do an opinion. I don't have an exact answer. I can answer partially, but I'd have to actually reference it and check to make sure. But the question Dr. Hammond asked for the audience that's not here, probably can't pick it up on the mic, is he asked if why is Robert Kennedy as a major candidate for the Democratic Party not getting Secret Service protection? And what are my thoughts on it? Well, number one, I don't know if he's turned it down. Sometimes candidates turn it down. So I don't know that status. That might be the case. There's a threshold when you declare for candidacy for president when you get Secret Service protection automatically. If you're the nominee, that's definitely the case. But sometimes before that, during the primary season, which is what we're in now, candidates get it if there's a threat. I don't know the threshold where it comes from, but I understand your concern, you know, with his uncle, Jack Kennedy, president, assassinated. His father, Bobby Kennedy, attorney general, assassinated, and president for Canada, was likely going to win that election. It's a very real concern. There are more than enough nut jobs out there that want to take politicians out, not just in America, but in South Africa. So it's a very good question. I don't know why he's not getting that protection. Again, it could be that he turned it down, but that would seem odd. You know, he's smart that he'd probably want that protection. So I'll have to take a look into it, Dr. Hammond. That's a fascinating question, and maybe I can get an answer. I'll get back to you. Paulie.
Based on mainstream media, last night at the Fox-Rhino debate, it appears that Vivek, I don't know the gentleman's surname.
Ramaswamy.
Has come out as was the odds-on favorite from the most popular from last night. Mm. If Trump wins next year, who's his deputy president and why?
Well, we don't have a deputy. We have a vice president.
Vice president.
you have a deputy president here. I think that Vivek Ramaswamy is a strong candidate to be a vice president. And in my personal view, would be a good pick. Of all the candidates other than Trump that are running in this election, only two remotely interest me. Vivek Ramaswamy and Robert Kennedy Jr. I don't know that I would vote for him, but he interests me. And the reason I don't know to vote for him with Kennedy is that I heard him give a very, what I believe to be naive response answering a question about China. He made an unequivocal statement in which he said that the reason China's a threat is because we're not nice enough to them. We make them a threat. Those are my words, but that's his sentiment. He said that about 2 months ago, and I did a double take. I'm like, did I just hear him correctly? China is a threat because China has a plan to be the unipolar power on the planet, and they've been running that plan for 40 years now, and they're not that far from achieving that. They're now a bipolar power with the United States, and maybe a tripolar if you include the European Union as a bloc, but that's their goal, and they'll get there one way or another. It doesn't matter how nice we are. We sponsor their entry into the World Trade Organization, and what do? They violate a copyright, trademark. They ban services and products from coming to their country. They did intellectual property theft. They spied on industrial espionage. And they have pillaged the world over. And so that's not because we weren't nice to them. That's because they had a goal. Yes, Paul?
Why is DeSantis fallen by the wayside? Is that because he's an actual threat? So Trump is just sort of...
Interesting point. So my neighbor back in Pennsylvania who voted for Trump previously told me several months ago that he hopes Trump would not run before he announced it. And I said, why? Because it's going to be a big distraction. I want DeSantis. I said, well, whoever you want to run, it's probably best that DeSantis is not the focus of attention right now because they're beating up Trump. But the moment DeSantis announces he's going to be a candidate, he'll become a target. And that's exactly what happened in the media. As soon as DeSantis announced his candidacy, he became a target. And everything he did in Florida was racist and it was all wrong. And they attack, they utter nonsense, the things they say. And he's trying to protect children in schools. They're putting textbooks there with pornographic cartoons of sexual acts for six-year-olds, sexualizing children. And he banned that. And he was called a bigot because of that and a racist. I don't know what it has to do with race. It was sex. But anyway, so the point is that he became a target as soon as he announced. Now, a lot of people look at Ron DeSantis as a Republican name only. I don't know that that's true. I think he is a genuine conservative. But he's had a lot of stumbles in his campaign. He has not proven to hit the mark a few times. So he's kind of fallen by the wayside. Right now, as you said last night, I didn't see it, but Vivek Ramaswamy, I'm not surprised. He's very articulate, very smart, very conservative, and believes in God, flag, and family. Faith, family, and flag he believes in. So it's interesting. But if Vivek Ramaswamy were to win the election, then the UK would be run by someone of Indian descent. The United States would be run by somebody of Indian descent. And India would be run by somebody of Indian descent, Modi. So we'll see what happens. But DeSantis is proving to be not particularly effective on the campaign trail. But it's early. We haven't had any primaries. Things change like that. Edmund Muskie was the top candidate back in the 60s. And he cried on the campaign trail in New Hampshire. And that was the end of his campaign. It just died right there. So things can change very quickly. Hillary Clinton was the shoo-in candidate, but Barack Obama beat her. She was going to win, and she lost. So things can change quickly.
This year?
No. Previous election. I'm talking, yeah, Muskie was in 68, yeah. And then Hillary Clinton, when she ran against Obama in 2008, she was the shoo-in. You know, it's her time. She's the anointed one. The queen takes over now. Only she lost to Barack Obama, one-term senator who only served part of his term. So with elections, you never know. It changes on a dime. And the media has such a big role in it, folks. The media plays such a big role in it. And the same in South Africa. The media plays a role. As I asked that question, only really about three of you had actually heard about or were familiar with the National Convention. And now you have the multi-party coalition for South, or multi-party charter for South Africa. Hashtag Charter 24. But most of you don't know about that because the media didn't tell you much about it. The parties did a poor job of sharing that. So there's a question here.
If Trump and or Kennedy are cheated out of the primary election, could that lead to the formation of a real third party and perhaps the destruction of the two-party system?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by cheat. If they don't get it, regardless of what happens, it's highly unlikely the United States will have a major third party. George Washington warned us about the dangers of political parties, and he was 100% correct. Over time, we've gone from a multi-party system to just two major parties. They are so powerful, so entrenched, that anything comes along is unlikely. We had the Reform Party, which looked like it was going to go very far. Ross Perot, it faded off the screen. We have many other parties. We have the Constitutional Party, but they barely get anything. We have the American Communist Party. We have the Green Party. We have lots of political parties. But these parties are so powerful and have such great influence and so much money that it's highly unlikely that any other party will form in our lifetimes. So regardless of what happens in this election. Good question, though. Yes, sir. Let me get this gentleman here first, Dr. Hammond. Okay. Yes.
Mark Twain said if voting changed anything, they wouldn't let us do it. And I'm starting to really believe this more and more since 2016. So this is just entertainment, really, in my opinion.
Okay.
It's WWE wrestling. Trump is Hulk Hogan. And you've got your other candidates, whoever they are, Mankind or whatever, if you didn't watch WWE wrestling, mm-hmm. It's terrible. It's all fixed, it's all fake, it's nonsense. And I can't believe that people are going to go again with their hopes up. These people will not allow it to happen. We saw it happen right in front of their eyes. Trump 2016, I think, and Brexit, they caught them off guard, possibly. Then what happened with Brexit was actually Britain didn't get Brexit, they got more immigrants. And Trump would just wash over. In fact, you had Black Lives Matter riots, and he made everybody take a vaccine. So who can vote for nobody? Because that guy, Mark Twain, was right. And that's how I see it now, currently. Sorry if I offended anyone.
Not offended. I believe in free speech. Why would I be offended by your free speech? Everyone's entitled to their opinions and views, and I understand your cynicism. But I would argue that things changed dramatically when Trump was elected, whether it caught people off guard or not.
It's hope, because people are awakening. I'm not a negative person.
But I misunderstood. I thought you said the elections aren't going to matter. Did I misunderstand?
That means that people are starting to wake up, and that there's going to, if you're awake, then you can have try something new, to try something different.
Well, short of, I mean, other than elections, what is there, revolution?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. No, so I'm asking what you're getting at. Okay. I'm not advocating that. Okay. So,
no,
but
I mean, okay. I wouldn't. I mean, I'd say why not? I mean, if somebody did advocate it, I'd say awesome.
Gotcha.
Brilliant idea. All
right. Well, having served in combat multiple times, people die, and so yes, I'm a little nervous about that. Dr. Hammond.
Pulling up your comment that third parties don't work in America in particular. Interesting mention about the U.S. Communist Party. I went on to the Communist Party USA website a while ago, and the intriguing thing is they had a statement there saying it was an upcoming election, and said Communist Party USA is not planning on putting up any candidates in upcoming elections, but advised all Congress to vote for the Democratic Party candidate.
Well, that tells you a lot about the Democratic Party, doesn't it?
The Communist Party seems to have hijacked the DNC. But I went to the Communist Party of South Africa, Southern Communist Party, SACP website, and they stated before the last elections, the SACP is not planning on placing any candidates up for the upcoming election.
Vote for the ANC.
Advises all candidates to vote for the ANC candidate. So that tells you that they don't try to win in their own name, they hijack existing organizations.
Absolutely.
I thought that was very interesting.
No, it's a very good point, Dr. Hammond. So, I mean, that is exactly the case. All senior members of the ANC historically have been senior members of the South African Communist Party, which only has about 50,000 members. It's not even much to it, and they don't really run, other than Blade Nsimande, you know, who do you know from the South African Communist Party? Anybody know? You know his name, because he was chairman for such a long time, and he was a minister in government. But what's that? Joe Slovo.
Oh, Joe Slovo, yeah.
Yeah, that was a long time ago. So, but I mean, I'm talking about recently. Yeah, but I mean, that's. But I mean, all the leadership of the ANC, they're in lockstep. There's no difference. There's no space. The National Democratic Revolution is pure communism, and it's disguised as socialism. But the ultimate goal is communism. The ultimate goal is state control of all means of production, all the land under state control, and they know better than you, and they know better than me, and they'll decide what you get to everyone. We get equal shares, which, of course, we all know means translates to the elites get theirs, and the rest of us get the shaft. And, of course, we go to gulags and prisons if we speak up, and today it's not just the government that will do it to us. The social media will do it to us as well, silencing us. So, good point, Dr. Hem. Yes, sir?
Building on JP's point.
Hope or cynicism?
Not quite. Hope, ideally.
Okay, hope.
What is your view on secession or nullification, both in the American and South African context?
Okay. That's a good, fantastic question, actually. Let me try to address it from the American side first. Secession is tried. It's not really in the Constitution. It was tried, and it was defeated. Texas, people are talking about Texas seceding. I think it's unlikely that that's going to happen in my lifetime. Maybe. We'll see. But I think it's unlikely. Nullification is an interesting legal concept in which if something runs counter to the Constitution, states will essentially nullify that and not follow that law or not follow the portion of the federal law or Constitution or the violation of the Constitution, I should say. It's interesting. It's been argued many times, and there are people saying that if the federal government is simply violating the Constitution. I mean, look, the federal government has an equal protection clause. The 14th Amendment puts equal protection for all Americans under the law. So everyone's equal before the law. Except they had affirmative action for 5 decades, which gave people preferential hiring based on their skin pigmentation. That is racist. If you're white and you get hired because you're white, and the brown and black people don't get hired, that's racist. If you're black and you get hired because you're black, and the white and brown people don't get hired, that's racist. There's no difference. Yet for 5 decades, the courts allowed that disgusting piece of legislation to exist because we had to, as South Africans know quite well, right historical wrongs. You don't right historical wrongs by giving people artificial advantage. You right historical wrongs by treating everybody fairly and giving everybody equal opportunity and access to things. That's how you right things. That's how you fix things. Instead of lowering the educational standards in this country to 30% in 3 subjects and 40% in your first language to pass matric, you raise the standard and you teach everybody properly so they're functional. But of course, governments don't always want an informed, literate, critical thinking electorate. They want people who are illiterate and unable to think critically. And that's the case here and in America. So in the South African context, of course, we're in the Western Cape, as some people call it, the Republic of the Western Cape. Some people are calling it that. There are a few independence movements here. Of course, you know, the Cape Independence Advocacy Group, Phil Craig leads that. We've got the United Liberty Alliance, which is Hein Marks. And then Cape Exit, Des Palm lead those groups. I've interviewed all those leaders. I've talked to them. I've met them all in person more than once. And they're not the only ones. Other people got the Cape Independence Party, Jack Miller. And so there are a lot of people working on Cape Exit. Is it technically and legally feasible? Yes. Under your constitution, under international norms, it is possible. We saw Catalonia was unsuccessful getting away from Spain recently, but that was a different situation. It has happened in the past. It can be done. Will it happen? I don't know. And as far as nullification, I would say that the African National Congress has been nullifying large portions of your constitution since the day it took power. So nullification is already taking place in South Africa, in my view. They simply ignore it. The constitution is in conflict. Everybody gets treated equal, but we have to right historical wrongs.
Some are more equal than others.
So. Yeah, exactly. So especially if they're caters, that's who's the most equal. So, the ANC, in my view, again, my view, not someone else's, the ANC rules for its caters. Not for South Africans, not for black South Africans, not for Venda, not for Xhosa, not for Zulu, not for Basutu, not for Tswana, or the Khoi or the San, or Portuguese, German, white, black, South African. They rule for caters. That's who they rule for. They claim they're for everybody else, but how do you explain an informal settlement Northwest that 30 years later has seen zero change other than a couple little outhouses, outdoor privies put in their location? A caring government would have moved those people from there, or would have come up with some scheme, particularly if that's a responsibility. I mean, that's in my government, we don't build houses. The government doesn't build houses for people. That's the responsibility of the private sector, for the most part. We do have some social housing, but it's not a major thing. But that is the role of government here in South Africa. And 30 years later, nothing's happened. And I can go 1,000 places in South Africa, and the story plays out the same everywhere. There's a problem here, and the only thing has changed. So, did I answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Any other questions?
He
beat you again, Dr. Hammond. Go ahead.
How much power does the government have to change the private sector? Because a lot of the problems, I'm always thinking of an American case scenario. The private sectors where people are basically, that affects their everyday life, the finances, the money, where you can buy a house, if you can end up on the streets or not because you don't have a job. Mm-hmm. So how much can the government change that and reform it if they ever... Can they change it?
Which government? South African or American?
American government.
Well, first off, you have to understand that we have a federal system, very different than South Africa. You have a pseudo-parliamentary system. First off, you have a president, but you know who voted for Ramaphosa to be president? None of you. The members of parliament voted for him. That's a parliamentary system. So the parliament selected the president. We select the president. Now, yes, we have an electoral college, which ensures that there's no tyranny of the majority, but we vote directly for the president in our states, and that determines the electors who select the president. We vote for our politicians. There's no party list. We don't go select Republican, Democrat. We vote for Chris Wyatt or Joe Slovo or whoever's on there. And we can throw the bum out the next election. The federal government has certain powers, but under the Constitution, they're very limited. Sadly, for the past century, my federal government has progressively grown bigger and bigger and bigger because they've sucked more money out of the economy and asserted more authority, much of which they have no constitutional right to do. For instance, there's nothing in the Constitution that gives the federal government the right to regulate abortions. Nothing whatsoever. That's purely made up fiction that led to the death of 50 million Americans in the womb. 50 million. 50 million. And by the way, one-third of those, over one-third, were black kids. So... anyway, we talk about that issue, but the rates there are much higher. So there's nothing in it. In fact, the 10th Amendment to the Constitution specifically restricts the federal government from anything that's not specifically enumerated in the Constitution. If it's not in the Constitution, then they're not allowed to do it. Yet they have usurped authority from the states. We are a union of 50 sovereign states. But for the past century, ever since the income tax was introduced at the beginning of the 20th century, the federal government's got bigger and bigger and bigger. The excuse was the Second World War, then it was Korea, then it was Vietnam, then it was the Great Society, you know, it was the Depression, all these excuses for the federal government creating institutions and creating rules and regulations. So, in theory, the federal government is very limited and the states have those responsibilities. Each state is different. So every state has different laws on certain things. Some states you can drink alcohol when you're 18. Some states when you're 21. Some states you can get a driver's license when you're 14 if you work on a farm to drive the tractor and truck like I did. In other states, you have to be 16. So the rules are different, but they're generally the same, and there's a lot of reciprocity with agreements. So, for instance, my driver's license, which is in my wallet, is accepted in all 50 states. So as far as the government controlling things and changing things, the federal government has limited powers to do that. I will tell you this. A president can't normally change things at the macroeconomic level in our country for the good quickly. Trump was an exception because there's some very easy victories for him to do, like lowering federal corporate income tax and income taxes. But generally, they can screw the economy up just like that. And they can make decisions and push executive orders and cripple our economy overnight. But it's very difficult for them to change it for the better. I'm not sure I answered your question, but I think I did. Okay, cool. Dr. Hamm.
There's this horrible war going on in Ukraine right
yes.
now. And how's the upcoming election of 2024 going to affect that war, particularly when you think of the possibility that the potential for escalating, getting out of control, embroiling Europe, NATO, including nukes and all this, the results could be absolutely catastrophic. And then there's China and Taiwan. So how do you see the possibility of war with China over Taiwan, war with Russia, and how would the election results affect those wars?
Well, those are speculation, but I have views on them, so I'll share them because that's what you're asking. I will say this. Under George Walker Bush, Putin invaded Georgia and tried to conquer it. And the only reason Georgia didn't collapse in no measure is because they fought for their lives to the bitter end, kind of like Israel does, but also because the U.S. gave massive military assistance and training to the Georgians, which helped them immensely. So Putin invades Georgia when Bush is president. When Obama's president, he invades the Crimea, occupies it, annexes it. Obama does nothing. Also invaded the eastern Donbass, Russian-speaking region of the Ukraine, and occupied it. And that war didn't start in February last year, we're talking about. It's been going on since 2014, just on a low level. Remember, the Russian soldiers disguised as local militia shot down a Malaysian aircraft, killing all the people on board with a surface-to-air missile a few years ago. So if Trump becomes president, he says he'll end the war in a day. That's nice if Donald Trump say that, but I think that's unlikely. I don't know if Trump will try to end the war, he'll be able to end the war, but I do know, I'm pretty confident that Trump will stop sending military assistance to Ukraine, and that will probably dry up overnight, would be my expectation. We give, I think last time I was here, I gave the figures, and it's gone up much more since then, so I'll just try to get the numbers off the top of my head here. But I did this. I wrote an article last year about how much foreign assistance the United States gives to all of Africa. And early in this conflict, we had already given Ukraine more money than we'd given the entire continent of Africa, with $1.3 billion over a five-year period.
Why?
That's a good question. But it seemed to keep Hunter Biden's laptop off the front page for a long time. It seemed to keep the FBI's violation of our constitutional rights and their warrantless activity, their criminal activity of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, as I like to call them, Federal Bureau of Incompetence. They have been violating the Constitution left and right. We saw this, we believed it for years, and we actually have the evidence of it now, thanks to Elon Musk.
So you're suspecting in your own, in different words, it's essentially a distraction.
Yes, I think it is a distraction. I mean, first off, the argument that if you don't support, when it started, I'm not sure because I wasn't here when it started. I was in the States and I didn't come here until August after it got going. When this started, if you didn't support Ukraine, it's like you were a communist or a pedo, you know. Ooh, you know.
Put the
patch on. Ukraine. Ooh, I'm for Ukraine. Look, Ukraine is the most corrupt country in Europe, except for maybe Montenegro. I don't know, but it's one of the, maybe Montenegro's not the one, but it's the most corrupt country in all of Europe before the conflict began. And I'd like to know where the $146 billion that we've given them have gone to. I know we've given them over 1 million artillery rounds. The ultimate story here is that civilians are dying on both sides, and soldiers, many of whom are conscripts, who didn't ask to be put in this, are also dying. And for what? For politicians.
So this is an American proxy war?
Oh, it's definitely a proxy war for NATO and for the United States. Yes. There's no doubt about it, in my view. I've said that all along. It's a proxy war. And the question is why? And is it a distraction? What's going on here? It's certainly not about democracy. I mean, look, when I went to the Gulf War in 1990, President George Herbert Walker Bush, whom I have a I've had a good opinion of most of my life, but maybe I'm changing that in my older age. But George Herbert Walker Bush said, we're going to kick the Iraqis out of Kuwait to restore Kuwait's sovereignty. I'm good there. To protect global supply of oil. I'm good there for energy for the world. And then he said, restore democracy in Kuwait. And that's when I kind of lost it. Democracy in Kuwait? There's no democracy in Kuwait. They treat their third country nationals like virtual slaves. And it's just, it's a kingdom. So that's not democracy. And the same with Ukraine. Democracy? No democracy in Ukraine. That's a joke. Volodymyr Zelensky has banned the use of Russian. He has banned the Russian Orthodox Church. He has banned opposition parties and refuses to say when they'll hold an election. Now, under their law, that's his right, the last one. They're not required to have an election when they're in conflict, so that's true. But given all the banning he's been doing against anyone who opposes him, you'd think that maybe he'd say, hey, you know, we're thinking of having an election a year or this day, depending on where the state of conflict is. I was asked, when is this going to end? And my view on February was 23rd last year is when it started, I think. I was actually at the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Convention. It happens annually. I went to Orlando, Florida, as a journalist to cover it. And I got there. I was late because American Airlines delayed my flight. Surprise, surprise. And then my car was wrong at the hire, so I had to get a different one. So I get to the hotel after midnight, and I went in about, it was about 1 o'clock, 1:30 in the morning. I turned on my laptop, turned the TV on, I was going to get a shower because it was so humid. And the war had started. So I did a live broadcast right there, sight unseen. I just went live and told my viewers what was going on from my perspective and how we got here and what's going to happen next. And the question that came up in the chat was, well, what do you think is going to happen? I said, well, I suspect this will be a slow burn conflict that will last at least 3 to 5 years at a minimum. And we'll see high and low levels of combat. It's not going to end anytime soon. That was before the U.S. and NATO and Estonia and Germany and France started throwing weapons into it. It's not going to end anytime. The Russians had a very boneheaded strategic plan. I don't understand who was designing it. Their generals need to be axed. Prigozhin had a point. You know, you don't attack on 7 disconnected axes at the same time from all these different locations. They should have attacked on just a couple of them. I'm talking about from an operational standpoint, from the Crimea, from Eastern Donbass, link up, encircle those forces there, and then whatever your objective is, go on from there. But they came in from the north, they came in from here, they attacked Snake Island, they went there, they went here, and they had seams and gaps, and the Ukrainians were able to exploit those and stop their advances because their flanks were threatened. And so you notice they got to Kiev, and before they got in the city, they pulled back because their flanks were being, they were threatened to being cut off from behind because of the poor decision-making. They've also put old equipment into the conflict. They're driving T-72s into combat. Those are 50-year-old tanks. They've got T-90s and other new ones. Why aren't those in the battlefield until they just started showing up? So I don't understand the war plan was all about. I suspect two things, and I've said this many times, the first one, that Vladimir Putin made a calculation that there would never be anybody as stupid as Joe Biden in the White House ever again. And that now is the time to strike. I mean, now is the time to strike because his long-term goal, in my view, I'm not in his head, none of us really know, even the people around him don't know what his goal is, but I've always thought that his actual goal was to move the Russian border to the Dnieper River, which is a more natural geographic boundary, and incorporate the eastern third of Ukraine into Russia. He's got the Crimea, that makes sense. Maybe that's not his plan, but that's what I thought. So he made the determination that, hey, now's the time to do it. Let's just run back the clock here very quickly since we're talking about Ukraine. Joe Biden becomes president on what, January 21st of 2021, I think it is. He gets sworn in. 9 days later, on the 1st of February, what happened in Myanmar? A military junta overthrew the democratically, but thoroughly corrupt, but democratically elected government of Myanmar under Aung San Suu Kyi. Remember her? She was Nobel Peace Prize winner, was in prison for like 20 years. She's back in prison, 79 years old now, because they've locked her up, and they're having military tribunals and executing former members of parliament from the opposition party, and they're murdering civilians. And what's going on? Is anyone talking about it?
No.
I am, but I mean, I don't have a global audience of the size that, say, Tucker Carlson does. By the way, did anybody see that his interview with Trump last night had 161 million views in less than 12 hours? 161 million views! Outfoxed News. Held the debate last night. I'll bet you they didn't have 5 million people watching. Anyway, but so that happens. What does Biden do? What's the response? Nothing. We're all about democracy, right? America's democratic values. We're pushing democracy in Africa, right? Why aren't we saying anything about Myanmar? Military government's overthrown them. We're silent. 6 weeks after Biden becomes president, Putin moves 70,000 troops to the Ukrainian border. 70,000! It wasn't a state secret. It was in the press. What did Biden say? Nothing. Then Biden announces that the United States is withdrawing from the war in Afghanistan, which of course was a lie. The war in Afghanistan had ended for the United States. When those soldiers were killed in 2021, it had been 18 months since the last combat casualty for U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Why is that? Because Trump had withdrawn from combat operations, and the troops that remained behind were trainers, training the Afghans on the equipment that our Congress gave them over the course of 20 years, $100 billion worth of military hardware, including sophisticated helicopters and such. So we were training them. Yes, there were combat forces there. There were special forces, a reaction team, so that if U.S. forces were in danger, they would respond to protect them. But we had not engaged in a single combat operation in 18 months. Joe Biden lied to America, and most Americans are poorly informed, they fell for it. Just like most Americans are up in arms. Well, we left all the equipment behind. Folks, your congressmen and women voted appropriations over the course of 20 years to buy that equipment and give it to Afghanistan. Instead of giving them AK-47s and 81mm mortars and training them to do combat patrols, we gave them Black Hawks and advanced to multiple launch rocket systems and things that they could not maintain, that we wasted. And who knows why we did that. So that's what happened there. And once Putin saw that Myanmar, nothing was done, then we had coups in Africa too, right? We had Burkina Faso and Niger had an attempted coup. Now they've had the coup. They tried to murder President Bazoum before he went in office. They tried to assassinate him in a coup attempt, but that was thwarted. Now they have a coup. So those things are happening. The troops move there, then Afghanistan. I mean, if you're Putin, what are you going to say? If you want the eastern third of Ukraine, what are you going to wait for? Go for it. Now, I think that his generals, or maybe Putin believed his own press. He thought his army was good. Obviously, the Russian army is not as good as people make it out to be because of their flawed operational and strategic plan to attack Ukraine and the stalemate that we've been in ever since then. You have a huge army, huge resources, and they can't defeat the Ukrainians. Ukrainians, the forces on the ground, fought some heroic battles, made some smart moves. But, of course, when people keep giving you hardware that you don't have to buy, it's easy to expend it. But their tactics are pretty flawed, too. We watched as Leopards and U.S. Bradleys were just taken out in a minefield by the Russians because they had no plan on how to enter the minefield. And foolishly, obviously, they're not well-trained. If you're a soldier and you get in a kill zone, you fight your way out of it. You don't sit there and take shells and let people shoot you. You push through and fight your way out of it. People are going to die, but some of you might survive. But if you stay in a kill zone, you're all going to die. And that's what's been happening with Ukrainians. So that's a stalemate, and it's not going to end. Remember the great spring offensive? Whoa, Joe Biden, the spring offensive. Okay, the late spring offensive. The early summer offensive. Where's the Ukraine offensive? It's gone nowhere, the counteroffensive. The media plays a role here, but our politicians are being dishonest with us. In the United States, we had a soldier in the National Guard, Air National Guard, disclose classified information from Pentagon briefings earlier this year. You may have seen that. After we're being told that 200,000 Russians had died and that the Ukrainians are doing so well, only to find out that the actual estimates, according to this classified document, which I can share with you because it's public, not because I know it because it's classified, that the order of Russians killed was more like 25 to 35,000 at that point, and that the number of tanks was wildly overstated that were destroyed on both sides, and the actual number of Ukrainians is probably about 50,000 that died in the conflict when they were telling us it was 10,000. So some of that's normal. Governments will lie because it's part of bluffing to win politically. But at this point, many of us are cynics about our governments. We don't trust what they say and what they do. So, I mean, did I answer your question, Dr. Hammond?
Well, you haven't touched China yet.
Oh, China, yeah, okay.
Potential war with China and how the upcoming elections affect that.
Sure. I have to say that I was surprised about Taiwan. Joe Biden has actually been a hawk on a couple occasions with regard to Taiwan. We've responded with the Indo-Pacific Command, which is based in Hawaii, moving carriers and moving naval aircraft towards Taiwan in the Sea of Japan to show a force on a couple occasions and also into the South China Sea in response to Chinese aggression. So that's actually surprised me. I didn't expect Joe Biden to do that because, I mean, like many people, I wonder if you know, his son getting money from China has anything to do with his decisions. But anyway, that's just another story. So I was actually surprised by that. And a lot of people have been talking about the potential conflict between Taiwan and China while the world is distracted by Ukraine. But we're now a year and a half into the Ukraine conflict and it hasn't happened yet. Not saying it won't happen. China's ultimate goal is to take possession of Formosa, Taiwan. That's what they want to do. And they've done some pretty horrific things. They had a naval exercise earlier this year in which their naval forces surrounded the island of Taiwan and they did a live fire exercise in the direction of the shore. The Taiwanese fishing fleet had to retreat because bullets were bouncing around about the sea. True story. I'm not making this up, folks. Look it up. It's true. That's horrific. That's an act of war. And they got away with it. Kind of like the North Koreans before Trump stroked Kim Jong-un's ego. They were flying intercontinental ballistic missiles over the Sea of Japan and over Japan's airspace. And that's an act of war. Yeah. I mean, the Japanese would have been fully justified in bombing North Korea. Foolish, but fully justified. But they held their fire. And Trump stroked the guy's ego and made him feel like he's important, puffed his chest out, and they stopped doing it. Biden comes in, now they're launching missiles over Japan again. You know, when you've got a weak foreign policy, this is what happens. Yes, sir?
Yes, you mentioned a couple of times that Biden did this and he come out of it. But who's, I mean, we know that he's not himself personally doing it. So who's yanking the strings behind the scene? I mean, this guy can't string a sentence together. He can't ride a bicycle in a straight line. So who's doing this? I mean, what's your opinion? You look at the vice president, for one. I mean,
she's clueless.
Yeah, totally. I mean, she's not even blonde.
No, we got it. Okay, without stepping on that landmine, I'll try to answer your question. Listen, we don't know. I suppose Joe Biden is competent. I don't know. But I will say this, and this to me is an indicator, okay? Susan Rice, do you know who she is?
Yeah.
Susan Rice? Okay, Susan Rice was in the national security team back in the Clinton administration. She's the one that famously said, if we call Rwanda genocide, what will happen in the midterms? Remember that? Yeah, that's what she said. And we know that because a military officer was present in that meeting and told people about it, and it's never been denied. So, I mean, her concern wasn't the 850,000 people being hacked to death with machetes, with pangas, in Rwanda.
Yeah.
Her concern was that if they called it genocide because that Clinton administration had done nothing to intervene, would they lose an election? Now, that is callous and inhuman in my book. And that's the kind of person she is. But she's famous, she's rich, she's well-connected. She was in the Clinton administration, she was in the Obama administration, and she's in the Biden administration until Joe Biden announced he was running for re-election and she suddenly resigned. So that tells me that maybe Susan Rice and the Obamaites have had some influence in this administration.
So you're saying that she couldn't take the ball?
I think when Joe Biden's ego was so big and he thought he was actually president, he announced he's going to run again. The plan wasn't for Biden to be a two-term president. The plan was to get rid of Trump, get Biden there, and then have people behind the scenes running the administration, and then the candidate they want run in 2024 and get elected. That's my thoughts. I have no evidence of any of that. It's pure speculation, but I'm not the only person that's made that assertion.
But you think all these wars that are starting all over the place are really CIA-induced because of the military hardware that America produces to keep that
going?
I mean, is that just a pie in the sky, or is there something in that?
That's an interesting question. People, I've worked with the CIA on occasion, abroad in deployments, because they're not allowed to work in the States. I mean, they do analysis in the States, but they can't do operation in the States. It's illegal if they do.
Yes, because they're international. Eh?
That's correct. Kind of like MI5 and MI6, there's a difference. Yeah. So they're only, the FBI is supposed to do domestic things when it comes to intelligence, and the FBI, and the CIA is abroad. I've worked with them abroad on a few occasions. I will tell you that, yes, the CIA has been involved in some pretty nefarious things, particularly back in the 60s and 50s and overthrows in Iran and places like that, and Latin America and places like that. But I'd argue that in my experience in the last 30 years, not recent because I've been out for 3 years now, people attribute things to CIA that they actually have no involvement with them whatsoever. And there's a lot of speculation anytime something happens. Like right now, Victoria Nuland is the big boogeyman, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, look, she's not a person that I would have a Christmas dinner with. But I mean, and she's definitely been showing up in places where things go sideways very quickly. So I could see how people draw that conclusion. But the CIA has the ability to do things, but I think that they're attributed a lot of things that are beyond their capacity. As far as selling weapons, the United States is the world's largest arms dealer. Statement of fact, we make billions of dollars by selling ammunition and weapons around the world. True story. But most of that stuff goes to Saudi Arabia and Taiwan and South Korea, places like that. That eats up most, and Israel. That's where most of that stuff goes. So like four countries. There's others that get it. I mean, we sell it to African countries too and European countries. But that total defense spending is for armaments is a fraction of our gross domestic product. In my view, it's not significant enough for what Eisenhower warned about the military-industrial complex. To me, that isn't there. I've worked in defense acquisition, and I just don't see it. You don't have to believe me. You can believe me. I'm just telling you from my experience, I worked in a $3 billion acquisition program at the National Security Agency. I was chief of staff. And I just don't see that. Even when I take the total amount of money the Defense Department uses for acquisition, you put it in a $27 trillion economy, we're talking $180, $200 billion a year. It's not that much. It's peanuts. So to me, that's not what's driving us. Like the argument, I saw it last night when I was on Big Daddy Liberty's program talking about the BRICS, and somebody, some troll was attacking me in the chat and talking about how I'm an intelligence operative and why the intelligence care about BRICS and all that. And it was going on and on, and he said that, yeah, of course, you know, the U.S. went to Iraq for the oil. Really? Which American oil companies are operating in Iraq? Can somebody name one? We spent trillions of dollars in Iraq. Not an American, not a single American oil company is operating in Iraq. Total is there, BP is there, but not a single American company. So that's just nonsense. You know, when I had an epiphany when I was a young officer and I went to Iraq or to Kuwait. I wasn't thrilled about going to the desert and going to combat. I was a young man. I was a second lieutenant. But I mean, you do.
You're talking about Iraq now.
The Gulf War, 1990-91. Yeah. I was sent there. I was in armor battalion, and I wasn't thrilled about it, but you do your duty, right? So I'm sitting there in my foxhole with the rain pouring down on me in the wintertime, and I'm thinking about what's going on, and I keep hearing all these leftists say that it's all about oil, it's all about oil, it's about oil. And eventually I said to myself, you know what, so what if it is about oil? The reality is the United States doesn't get that much oil from the Middle East. Who gets oil from the Middle East to keep their economies flowing? Anybody know?
Europe and Japan.
Yes, sir, that's correct. Europe and Japan. Japan has no oil. Britain has oil from the North Sea, Norway has lots of oil, Denmark has oil, but beyond that, almost nobody has any oil. So if Japan and Europe's economies are crippled, who suffers? They suffer, but who suffers more? The people that grow bananas, coffee?
Africa's apology.
Correct, that's right. The people at the bottom end of the chain, because when the economy contracts in a wealthy country, they stop buying luxuries. They stop buying things from abroad, and they come up with the substitutions at home. And so ultimately, the people who are poorest around the world are the ones suffer. The reality is this. We can talk green energy all you want, and unicorns and rainbows and solar panels and wind and cold fusion mumbo jumbo, whatever we talk about. But the reality is this. Modern life depends on the safe, and South Africans should know this story very well, the safe, reliable, affordable availability of energy. Pure and simple.
You talking about oil or
solar? Energy. Energy. Well, most of it comes either from coal or from petroleum. But it depends on that. Just look at ESCOM, the disaster here.
Yeah.
Look, I was talking to a fireman tonight about all the fires taking place in the Cape Flats because of the surges up and down, and houses catching on fire because of the damage done by the load shedding. Your economy is in shambles, in no small measure because of the inept, incompetent, malicious theft that's taking place at ESCOM. And we could talk about that for hours. The world relies on affordable, reliable energy. And that's just how it is. And all these people dreaming about, you know, no petroleum, that's a fantasy. Because the clothing you're wearing is made from petroleum, some of it. The medicines you consume are made from petroleum or coal. You know, paracetamol is made from coal. I don't know if you know that. Look it up. First time I had paracetamol, I was like, ew, it's made from coal. I'm eating coal? Yeah. Petroleum will always be around. Plastics are made from it. It won't go away. We'll use it. We may not use it to power generation plants for power or for petrol for our cars, because maybe we'll put cabbage in there, you know, like the Back to the Future, put a little fusion there. You know, but the point is that it'll always be around. So it's a fantasy to talk about not having it. But safe, reliable, affordable energy is what's needed. And you don't have that because of this nonsense in the energy sector. But back, just a second, back to 1991, my epiphany was this. If I was sent to Kuwait to free Kuwait from the Iraqis, who were threatening not just Kuwait, they just captured 6% of the world's oil reserves, plus they have their own 8%, so now they have 14%. Saudi Arabia had 25%. So suddenly they'll have almost half the world's oil reserves. The world's economy will be held hostage. And if I'm there to ensure that oil gets to the marketplace and Kuwait gets its sovereignty back, then I'm okay with that. Because it matters. That was the epiphany I had. Right or wrong, that was how I reconciled the fact that I'm sitting in the desert. I wasn't fighting for oil. I was fighting for the other guy. That's how I looked at it. You had a question.
Back to the topic of renewables and that.
Sure.
I think I know the answer to this, and you do too, but I just want to think it out in this room here. Do you know what energy is actually used to make the equipment that makes?
Yes, I do. And when you calculate the total carbon emission, just that alone, of digging up rare earth elements, wiping out mountainsides, polluting water streams, the energy that it takes to get those materials, to ship it to China, where most solar panels are made, to manufacture the solar panels in polluting factories in China, then ship them back around the world to the most polluting source of pollution on the planet, cargo ships, which burn kerosene and produce 3 or 6% of the world's carbon emissions just from the ships carrying those containers around the world. And then they deliver it to South Africa, then someone picks it up, they distribute it in multiple places, they burn carbon, taken out, then they install it. It takes a decade, in most cases, before you even reach parity with carbon from simply burning coal. So my answer to South Africa is energy crisis. There's no energy crisis here. You have a coal supply that will last 40 years. Burn, baby, burn. Burn coal. Get your baseline. Get back the 52,000 megawatts, 52 gigawatts of power, which you had 20 years ago in this country. Get back there. That will meet your demand. And then replace the factories, the plants as they were. Maintain them. Get the BEE out. Get the corrupt boards out. And burn coal. And then we can talk about unicorns and rainbows and coal fusion and solar panels. The only reason solar is remotely effective in this country is because ESCOM is a disaster. It's not economically viable or feasible for most people to use solar panels. The exception is South Africa because things are wrong. Yes, sir?
Talk about gas.
Natural gas.
That's fine. Gas.
Oh, they have lots of natural gas in the Karoo.
No. Where Sasol is.
Yeah?
So 2 kilometers away, last night, they talked about on the radio.
That they found a deposit of natural gas underground?
Yeah, a big.
Big seam of it, yeah. I'm not surprised. Look, I mean, it's funny how these green energy zealots have... I haven't forgotten. It's funny how these green energy zealots have hijacked the argument. 20 years ago, natural gas, let's all go to... It's green. It's less polluting. Now they consider it a danger. They want one of the solar panels. Natural gas is a very much cleaner burning source of energy, hydrocarbon, than any other. And there's lots of it. Algeria is a major producer of natural gas. The United States is a major producer through fracking and also through normal gas extraction, as well as Nigeria. There are plenty of gas producers, and there's nothing wrong with burning natural gas, in my view. And I believe there are pretty significant deposits of natural gas in the Karoo, which are not being exploited because fracking has been propagandized and made out to be a bad thing, when actually, if you look at the process of fracking, what happens is it's not the environmental disaster that the people who oppose it claim it is.
Could it get to the water sources?
Yeah, see, that's the problem. It's not true. There's casings that go through the rock layers and go past where the water sources are. The gas isn't coming from there, and it comes up outside of that. So you see in the States where they will see, look, we lit our spigot. When I was a kid, we had natural gas coming over spigot. There was no fracking. It seeps in the water table, and you could light your spigot, or you could smell the natural gas smell. That's just a natural occurrence. That's not because of fracking. Fracking, if it was because of fracking, you would not only have natural gas, you would have all kinds of lubricants and fluids coming out of your water, because that's what they use to frack with. It goes down into a pipe and gets pushed into the rock, which pushes out the gas. So that's a whole fantasy tale from my perspective. And I've done a lot. I'm also an energy industry analyst, and this is one of the topics I've talked a lot about. So that is a story that, like, Michael Moore has lied about. He's a big propagandist who lies about everything. You can't take anything he says at face value. Yes, I'm talking to you, Michael Moore. Sir.
I was just wondering about the stuff that they found off Namibia, off the coast. I mean, it's quite a big oil find.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. And how long would that take before that starts to take effect?
Well, I'm not sure how far they are from exploiting the oil offshore, but I think politics are going to play a role in that exploration.
Yeah.
I think there are some pigs at the trough that want to, and the Namibian government that want to get their turn to eat. Yeah. And you know, just like the fish rot scandal, it's going to be a problem. Uganda discovered oil, I think it was Tullow Oil, I think, found it. It's an Irish company, about 2007, 2008 in Uganda. And Uganda to this day has not pumped a single barrel of oil.
Wow. And Venezuela still holds the largest reserves, eh?
No. Venezuela, the largest reserves in the world are technically the United States. Wow. Saudi Arabia was the largest for years, but because of fracking and tight shale oil, and because of the Bakken Basin in North Dakota, United States is now estimated to have the largest oil reserves in the planet.
Reserves.
But that's because it comes from multiple sources, how we get it. Saudi Arabia has the easiest and cheapest, and they still have about 25% of the world's reserves. So the U.S. by BTU, British Thermal Unit, is the largest now. But actual barrels, reserves, Saudi Arabia is still the largest reserve on the planet. Venezuela's small. And Venezuelan oil is garbage. It's crap. So Angola is the same way. Angola is a major oil producer. They used to produce 2 million barrels a day. It's down to, I think, about 1.5 million barrels. By the way, all this information is available on the Energy Information Agency, the EIA, which is a site run by the U.S. government. It's available for free. Go look online, EIA. I think it's EIA.gov, but just look up EIA, Energy Information. You can look up energy consumption, energy shipping, you know, production all around the world, energy sales, particularly of oil, but also of other things. It's a great place for this information. It's a source I use frequently. It's the most objective source on the planet.
What do you think of Worldometer?
Of what?
Worldometer. It's a site that is an active site.
Oh, yeah, that's the site that used to count the so-called Rona deaths every day. Yeah.
All sorts of things, yeah.
No, it's a good data aggregator, right? Yeah. And we were all probably looking at it every day during the Rona.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Yeah. It was. Ooh, look at that. Ooh, the world's ending. Run away. I was fading back to 2020. I had a little PTSD there. Dr. Hammond.
What's the potential strategic implications of BRICS? BRICS is growing. We've part of BRICS. Russia's part of BRICS. Also is China. But now that they are making a major move to move off the petrodollar, I think this sounds like a bit of economic war to counter U.S. sanctions. Is there any danger that as BRICS expands, that America may start to see BRICS countries as a threat, and that they might, that we might get sucked into some kind of wars in the future? What's the strategic implications for BRICS?
That's a very good question. I should preface by saying that I'd encourage you to go watch the Cliff Central episode from this morning, the Burning Platform. I was a guest on there, and I talked extensively about this, but I'll talk about it now since you asked the question. I may not be the best person to ask because I don't take BRICS very seriously, and I'm as accredited journalist who was at BRICS covering it. I appreciate that Durko gave me accreditation since I kind of poo-pooed the BRICS itself. But it's an idea in search of existence. There's no treaty between BRICS nations. There's nothing obliges them to each other. One of the topics talked about the first day of the business forum was the Indian representative and the Brazilian representative were talking about trade barriers. And of course, they were talking about China preventing their goods from getting into China. But then China's like, we're all kumbaya, we're all friends here, and you know, we need to get rid of barriers. Well, dude, you're the one with the barriers. You're the one blocking the stuff from coming to your country, so fix it. But of course, they're not going to do that because it doesn't benefit them. So I'm kind of a skeptic on BRICS. It could be something. But in my view, it's nothing. And China is trying to use it as a wedge to draw people away from the developed world. And this idea of a separate currency is something they're trying to push, but that's not going to come early. Now, I get a little confused about how people use the term petrodollar, because that term is bandied about a lot. And they talk about the reason the dollar's out there is because of petroleum. It is true that petroleum around the world is traded in U.S. dollars. That's a statement of fact. But beyond that, a far bigger figure is that about 85% of international settlements and trade is settled in U.S. dollars. So the petrodollar is a term that really doesn't jive with me. I'm not saying it's not real, but it's something that people throw out there. And they talk about fiat currency, but every currency is fiat currency. Name a currency in the world that's backed by a tangible asset like gold or platinum. None are. The United States, and I talked about this on this program this morning, the United States used to back our currency with gold until Nixon. And people attack Nixon all the time. He took us off the gold standard. Oh, fiat money. Well, there's a reason he took us off the gold standard. France was trying to destroy America's economy. Gaulle had a grudge, and he tried to destroy America. Until 1972, when Nixon took us off the gold standard, you go in your wallet, you pull out a dollar bill. I don't have any dollars in here, so I'll use rand. You go to the Federal Reserve and say, give me gold. They were obliged to give you gold to that value. So de Gaulle, because there were so many dollars overseas, convinced people to turn their money to the Federal Reserve and diminish our gold supply. And so there was a run on U.S. gold. So Nixon took us off the gold supply the gold standard, so that people could redeem their dollars for gold because we didn't have enough gold. Fort Knox and all of our gold reserves in New York would have been depleted almost overnight, and it would have damaged the U.S. economy. So every currency is fiat currency. So when I hear them talking about BRICS, about how they're going to have a gold-backed currency, that's ludicrous. The world's economy is too large. There's too much money, too much value. There's not enough gold. Do you know that all the world's gold, if you put it ever mind, go back to the Greek, ancient times, Greece and Africa and Musimani, the guy who had the gold from Mali who went on Hajj to Riyadh. If you take all the gold and all the gold South Africa's produced, it fits in like 7.5 Olympic-sized swimming pools. Look it up.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. Look it up. I'm not making this up. That's the figure. Like 7.5 Olympic pools. That's it. That's not a lot, right?
Do some countries store their gold in the Federal Reserve?
Yes, the United States is the largest location for gold stored.
Okay.
And we had gold from like countries like Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia when the Soviets occupied them. We kept it for decades for them. We held on to it. Okay. So when they got their independence back, so I think it's still stored there, but it's theirs again.
Okay.
We didn't let the Soviets have it. But yeah, we store gold for people all over the world. Our banks do in the U.S., yeah. But we're not the only ones. I mean, Switzerland does it, and I think the Brits do a little bit too.
There's nothing federal about the reserve, though, is it?
That's a whole other topic. And the independence of our central bank, whether it has it or not. I think the reason why there's even talk about a BRICS currency is because my Congress and the Federal Reserve have bastardized our currency for the last four decades with quantitative easing by printing more money and putting it out there and increasing the money supply, and also by artificially keeping interest rates low so the government could issue debt at almost no cost. And as a consequence, we are deeply in debt, but the debt you see is a fraction of the debt. You hear about $34 trillion in federal debt.
Yeah.
The total debt for the United States is something in the order of $200 trillion. Because there's the federal government, there are 50 state governments, there are hundreds of counties or thousands of counties with debt, municipalities with debt, then there are consumers with debt, then there's mortgage debt, then there's corporate debt, although corporate debt isn't necessarily bad because corporations make profit and then they pay off their debt. But all of that debt together, and then the biggest one of all is unfunded pension liabilities. California pension system, CalPERS, is unfunded to the tune of billions of dollars. The General Motors pension fund, one of the reasons why it went bankrupt is because they had like $40 billion or more in debt for that and they couldn't make the pension payments. So that's a scary thing. So that's out there. So that's a big concern. I'm not trying to run out of here, but is it time to wrap up or? Oh, okay. I didn't know if I was getting the hook there. You know. Anyway, so did I answer your question?
I was just listening to Joe Rogan and Ben Shapiro. These guys, they did a bit of a bolt on California. So is California suffering a bit of a drain at the moment of businesses or because of Newsom?
Well, not just because of Newsom. I mean, California has done some really idiotic things. California's declared itself a sanctuary state for criminal alien invaders who violate our sovereignty.
And who put that in place?
Well, that's been before Newsom.
That was
previous. But now under Newsom, they've declared themselves a sanctuary state for minor children who identify as something other than their biological. I'll just leave it at that, okay? So if a child says, I'm not this, I'm that, and they flee to California, and they're underage, the state will give them succor and protection and violate the parental rights of the parent.
And is there a reason for this?
Because they're freaking wackadoodles.
They're
wackadoodles.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to explain it. How does anybody violate parental rights like that?
Yeah.
It's insane. It's absolutely insane. It undermines social cohesion. And it's what communists do, you know? They indoctrinate children to hate their parents and turn against their parents. It's what Fode Sanko and the United Revolutionary Front did in Sierra Leone. They hopped up kids on drugs, had kids rape their parents, murder their parents while they're on drugs, and just destroyed society. Then they started chopping hands off because people were voting. It's what they do. They destroy society. California is gone. It's gone. I mean, it doesn't mean it can't come back. But the thing is that a fair portion of Californians are actually conservative. It was just 10 years ago that California had a referendum on gay marriage. How do you think they voted? For or against gay marriage, California voters?
Wait.
Okay.
10 years ago.
10 years ago.
Against?
Against.
Yeah.
62% of Californians voted against gay marriage.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the state approved it anyway. So, against the voters. It was on a referendum. So, I mean, look, it's a crazy situation. The world is nuts, and that's why it's incumbent on good, honest, and God-fearing people to step forward and do the right thing here and in states. So,
with this trillion-dollar debt, who is it owed to?
Good question. So that's a question that comes up frequently. Are we still good there? Okay. All right. A question that comes up frequently is that I heard this about 10 years ago. The Americans have to do what China says because China owns all their debt. That's nonsense. I do research on this sort of thing. 2/3 of all U.S. federal debt, that's the federal government debt, $34 trillion, is owed to Americans and American institutions. We owe ourselves. So insurance companies, pension funds, investment companies, individuals like myself. I just bought a treasury bill when I got a discount on it because our credit rating was lowered, so it was cheaper. we owe that to ourselves. Only 1/3 of our debt is owed to foreign entities. And Japan has traditionally been the largest holder of foreign debt by buying treasury bills and treasury bonds. They've consistently done it. They average between 7 and 9% of our total debt. They keep buying it and then circling through. China briefly surpassed them until a decade ago when China's economy was overheating, so they had to do something. They bought U.S. bonds and bills, and they went from the third or fourth largest to the first, briefly. And then they started selling it off. So they're now second. They're down around 7 last time I checked. Beyond that, it's traditionally the United Kingdom at around 3 or 4% of our debt, and then Germany with 2%, and then some other players. So
the United Kingdom's in debt.
Yeah, we're in debt too. We own foreign debt for other countries. It's a shell game in some respects.
But somebody's very wealthy.
Well, there's a lot of people very wealthy, right. So it's a good question, though, but most of our debt is held by Americans, American institutions, not foreign entities. So
what is the asset? If you're in debt, you've usually bought a house, right? You owe money. What's the asset that America's got for that debt?
The good faith and confidence the U.S. government will pay it off. That's it.
What did they buy with it?
Well, they pay. That's why it's such a waste. They pay Social Security with it. They pay for foreign wars. They pay for poverty reduction. They pay for highways with it. We overspend. So let me give you a figure that's going to.
Highways is still an asset.
Okay, fine. I thought you were making the point that we don't spend on things that are actually tangible, which we spend on both intangible and tangible things. So let me give you a figure that's going to scare you. Okay, in 2000. Just 23 years ago, right? The U.S. federal budget was $1.8 trillion, okay? Basically the size of the entire Chinese economy was our national budget. According to the Clinton administration in 2000, in Congress, we had a $330 billion surplus, something like that. But that's because they took almost $400 billion from Social Security. Or no, I'm sorry, it was $32 billion surplus. They took $300 billion from Social Security and put it in the budget, and so we went up to $32 billion surplus. But that's just kabuki theater. You can't take money from that. You know, it's not a real surplus. We're still in deficit by a couple hundred billion. Exactly. $1.8 trillion was our budget then. This year's budget proposed by the Biden administration is $6.9 trillion. $1.8 trillion, $6.9 trillion 2 decades later. Of that $6.9 trillion, $1.9 trillion is deficit spending. The deficit this year is larger than their entire federal budget was 23 years ago. But we have a taxing problem, right? No, we have a spending problem. Now, you're going to say, but Chris, inflation. We've had inflation at less than 3% for the last 20 years until Biden came in. So you account for all the inflation, and it's still a huge increase. And are we getting 3 times as much defense and, you know, infrastructure? And so, no, we're not. Something's wrong here. But that's a pretty scary figure.
How big is the American footprint in Asia and Africa at this stage in comparison to Russia and China? I mean, they just built that drone base for $20 billion something.
No. It was 115 million. Yeah.
115 million?
115 million, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a lot of money.
A lot of money,
yes. Yeah. So it depends what you mean by footprint. The United States economic footprint.
Financial.
Okay, the United States footprint in the Sahel economically is negligible, not much. Militarily negligible, but defense cooperation is significant, but being different. So that airbase, which people keep saying is an American airbase, that's not true. It's a Nigerian airbase. There's U.S. Air Force personnel there flying drones, and we share the information with Niger's forces.
Okay.
The reason the Americans stay on the base is because Niger can't pay to maintain it. It costs about $10 to $15 million a year to operate it. And they don't have the money.
Yeah.
So they asked us to stay.
Yeah.
So, but they control access to the base. They could tell us to leave any time, and we would leave.
You're talking military drones there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a state secret. There's military drones there.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is they're looking for trafficking across the Sahel, and they're also looking at terrorism. Terrorism and other things. So, yeah, that's absolutely. And it's not just Niger. They're flying in the region. So, yeah, so that's true. What was the rest of your question? Sorry.
Just about the coalition that was formed, saying that there was support if France tried to take back the land or possess the country for debt owed, supposedly. There were about 4 different countries, like Mali and Algeria, for one or two, and then there were about 3 others that said that they would join hands with regards to assisting these guys to kick France out, and I don't know exactly what's happened since then. I mean, this is only about 3 days ago. I read it.
Yeah, no, I didn't see this, but interest of full disclosure, which I'm all about on pretty much everything, is I was the person responsible for establishing the Office of Security Cooperation in our embassy in Niger, in Niamey. Okay. I established that office in 2012. I was the security cooperation officer, the first one ever, and set it up. And we were already in the process of helping them with drones, giving them drones for them, but it wasn't working very well. And that's why the base was built, for us to operate and train them so they could take over the program. But also, I was the person that was responsible for working with the Force Armée Nigérienne, the FAN, to help them with special forces training. And that's what led to the event eventually. I was gone, long gone by then, that led to the death of some U.S. special forces soldiers. Because the mission changed. It went from simply training to train and assist, which means, you know, you get involved. Right. Yeah, so that mission changed after I left. But I was the person that was there that got that mission set up. I was also in Mauritania, and I was security. I was the one to set the Security Cooperation Office up in Mauritania as well.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Okay, so you had quite a big footprint there.
Yeah, so I know the places. Yeah, and I have a long history with Niger from the standpoint that my classmate at the staff college in Tunisia, l'école d'état major, was a Nigerian, and he was a gendarmerie officer. So
he's still around, is
he? He is. I haven't talked to him since the coup. I think he's retired. I hope he's retired, because he doesn't want to be part of that. He's a very honest and forthright person and would never get involved with something like that. So hopefully he's safe and out of it. But I haven't heard so. You know, when a coup happens, you never know what's going on.
What's your take on the plane crash in Obama?
Prigozhin? I don't know. Is he really dead? I mean, that's the way I have to find out, you know, if he's really dead. But listen, I mean, again, we were talking about this downstairs while we were eating earlier. Look, I mean, when Prigozhin marched on Moscow and went like 800 kilometers in one day, I mean, like, dude, what are you stopping for? Just keep going. The moment he stopped, I'm like, he just signed his death warrant. The guy's going to have a traffic accident. He's going to fall out of the building from the 34th floor. Or he's going to have a plane crash. Well, a la Buddy Holly, he had a plane crash if he was on the plane. Yeah, exactly. Well, I hadn't thought about John Denver. Yeah, but yeah, or Leonard Skinner, you know. That's not a shocker to me. Not a shocker to me. Look, I mean, when you mess with the dragon, you get burned.
Yeah, I'm not too sure that he is, actually. I think...
Yeah, maybe he's alive. I don't know.
Total setup.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah. We'll see. Did you have a question?
What's your take on the spying, Five Eyes sort of thing? Edward Snowden, I'm sure you're familiar with all of that.
Sure. Okay, Five Eyes is a grouping of Anglophone countries that share information. So the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the U.S. That's not a state secret, so I can say that. I worked in that world, so what is done there I can't talk about. But Edward Snowden, I think he's a dirty rat, crumb ball, and that flies in the face of many people who disagree with me. States have a right to secrets. If you can't negotiate or you can't get information to deal with your opponents or with others, then you're going to be crushed. The Chinese built the African Union building in Addis Ababa. I used to work there. And whenever I have a conversation with my African colleagues, I'd say, can we go outside? Why? Dude, there's microphones everywhere in this building. Cameras everywhere. What are you talking about? And they didn't believe me. I could see the cameras, you know. And then a few years after I left Ethiopia, big splashy news story. Cameras found. Questions wondering why the Chinese construction people are still there 4 years after the building's been built. And why nobody except the Chinese can go on the top floors of the African Union building. Well, gee, you wonder why? Yeah, so, anyway. But states have a right to secrets. Edward Snowden is an arrogant clown who got people killed because of his "I know better than everybody else." That's my view on Edward Snowden. People may not agree with me, and that's fine. We can disagree. But I know lots of secrets. And I know things that my government probably shouldn't have done, but it's not my place legally to do that. If I have an objection to it, there's a process for it. Yeah. We have an inspector general process, and it's legitimate in my experience in the intelligence community. If you have an issue, you disagree with something, you go to the inspector general, and I've seen it dealt with. And I haven't seen any whistleblowers, you know, punished. I mean, it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. I'm just saying that's been my experience. I've seen it happen a couple of times. Edward Snowden decided that the fact that, according to him, I can neither confirm nor deny this, according to him, that we were spying on people using certain intelligence, and he stole that information, which wasn't his to steal, and then gave it to reporters in Hong Kong, including Glenn Greenwald, and then ran off to Russia rather than face the consequences. His revelations of those programs cost us billions of dollars in collection capability and resulted in the deaths of dozens of individuals who were executed for being spies. That's wrong.
That is factual.
That's factual. That's morally wrong. I have a problem. I also have a problem with, what's this, Julian Assange too.
Yeah,
I have a problem with him. Many people disagree with me. Many of my viewers disagree with me. And that's fine. It's your prerogative. You may be right. I may be right. Maybe we're both wrong.
All encryption's ever done is it's just made it harder to intercept, you know, the criminal. I mean, it's made it harder to intercept those who should be intercepted, such as terrorists or things like that. They want to go off the radar, we go to encrypt services. You know, I mean, if you don't have anything to hide, why worry? Why fear being snooped on?
Well, I think everyone has something to hide. And I tell this to people who are married. So if you're married, listen to what I'm saying. Don't respond because I don't want you to get in trouble. Okay? But think about this. Do you want your spouse to know everything that you're thinking in your head? You would have marital discord. I'm sure there's times you're angry with your spouse, some people, and there might be something you want to say in your head, but you don't say it. If your spouse was aware of everything you said, you'd have some. So we're all entitled to our secrets. It's whether we use our secrets for malicious or malevolent behavior that matters. That's the difference. That's my view. Again, you can disagree with me. These are not the views of the Reformation Society. These are my views. So anyway. States are entitled to the secrets. You have to go to the negotiating table. The reason why the Chinese wanted to know what was going on in the African Union, so when they sat down with African states and negotiated trade deals and cultural exchanges, they knew exactly what their cards were. They knew that the Africans were holding a bad hand. And they couldn't bluff, they couldn't negotiate because they knew all the information. So they're entitled to their secrets. Right? See? You see why? I mean, go to Vegas, right? Or go to a casino. If the dealer knows that you've got a 6 and a 9, and he gives you a 10, he knows you won, right? Without even flipping the card over. So, you know, the dealer can take a chance or not take a chance because he knows your position. And that's why states have a right to privacy. Now, states do not have a right to secrecy when it comes to things that people should know about, right? You know, foreign policy, what decisions are made, you know, there are things the public should know about. And that's what the media's job is. The fourth estate is responsible for holding governments accountable. Unfortunately, our media doesn't do that, and neither does your media, by and large. Although there is some good investigative reporting takes place in South Africa. Any more questions?
Who do you believe in the States and in South Africa are the leaders that can bring about the correct change or the positive change that's needed?
In South Africa?
For the masses, yes.
Oh, I'd really go out on a limb here. It's tough to say because I think a lot of them haven't really been tested. You know, there are people in Parliament who probably have good leadership skills, but have they really been tested? I think, for instance, let me talk about somebody I think is a very honorable man. I think Dr. Peter Hernevoort is a very honorable man. That's my assessment of him. I mean, again, that's my view. But the Freedom Front Plus has not really been tested. They haven't governed anywhere, have they? They've never governed.
It's a sad reality. Like I was saying to my wife some time, yeah. I say, right, tomorrow we're going to go and vote. Who do I vote for? Because out of all the leaders, you either never hear from them. Well, when you do, it's sometimes controversial or it's disappointing. So that's the problem, and I believe worldwide where you don't get leaders anymore.
Well, I can't disagree with you on that. I think that the world is suffering from a dearth of good, honest leadership. That's a fact. I agree with that 100%. Look, I voted for Donald Trump twice, and I'll vote for him again if he's the candidate. But I think he's a cad. I think he's a bore. I think he's a bully. But I also think he's a very effective leader, you know, in many respects. He also does some dumb things, you know. But look, nobody's perfect, you know. God's the only one that's perfect as far as I know. The rest of us are just trying to get through it as best we can, right? So I agree with you. There's a dearth of leadership. That's why several people asked me to run for office, and I'm contemplating it. I presume they think I'm a good leader. That's why they want me to do it. And maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. But I would say that my 36 years in the Army proved that I'm capable of leading. So, yeah. So anyway, but that's kind of where that's at. So, but I think we all need better leadership. But you know what? Maybe one of those leaders is sitting in this room. Maybe you step forward, you know, and attach yourself to one of these parties and become a candidate for one of these parties, and then get in office. Maybe that's the answer.
Do you think there's a possibility for a civil war in this country?
In South Africa? I think we were pretty close in July 2021. Sure, that's a possibility. I don't think it's a likelihood. It's a possibility. It all hinges on whether the ANC loses and if they give up power.
Yeah. You
know,
they bow gracefully.
You know? Yeah, but you know what? The ANC needs some time in the wilderness. They need to learn some humility.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they absolutely do. Dr. Hammond, are we wrapping up?
Well, I can ask another question.
No, okay, fine. I never know if I'm still welcome here, you know? I said I didn't like Snowden. Usually I get booed and they throw cabbage at me, so...
closer to Third World War than any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis, and that he can stop the Third World War, but that's assuming it doesn't break up before
he gets back, yeah.
What do you think is the likelihood of things spiraling into a general war and possibly even a nuclear war between NATO and Russia in the next year?
That's a good question. I'm not a person that, and I think the last 18 months helps bear this out, I'm not a person that's that thinks we're going to go to nuclear war. But I have said that we're on the verge of a nuclear war.
Yeah.
And that's because of our fueling a proxy war in Ukraine. I'm talking about the United States and NATO. Jens Stoltenberg and Joe Biden fueling this conflict. And with their willing friends in France, Estonia, and Germany in particular, and Poland as well. The Russians are unlikely, in my view, to use intercontinental ballistic missiles. There's nothing to be gained from that, even in a vindictive manner. But it's not beyond the realm of possibility the local commander could somehow launch a tactical weapon, and that would cause real problem. So that's a possibility. I think it's unlikely, but it's a legitimate possibility in this conflict. But I do think it's unlikely. That said, people do stupid things, and you know it only takes a moment. So, look, we really need to tone down the heat in Ukraine, get this under control. What's bothered me about America and about NATO from the outset is this: when has the United States proposed peace talks?
Never.
When have we offered to negotiate between Zelensky and Putin? No, what we've done is send more weapons and more weapons and more aid, and while 6 million Ukrainians flood Europe and people are dying in Ukraine. That's disturbing to me. Now, I think it's, I'll say this up front, I think it's a joke of the African leaders going up there, they're going to negotiate peace. Especially, you know, South Africa, you know, we're going to negotiate peace. Yeah, you guys are, your government's interlopers. And not very popular in much of Africa because it's a unilateralist government. The South African government has really irritated a lot of Africans. And I can tell you this from living across Africa. A lot of times people get very angry with South Africa's ANC government because, you know, they stick their finger in the mud and they act like bullies, like they're in charge and like they know better than anyone else. I mean, in the eyes of a lot of Africans, the ANC is no different than the former colonizers in their conduct. That's a fact. That's what's been shared with me, many Africans across the continent. And remember, I worked at the African Union, so I'm talking not just living in different countries all over Africa, but also talking to Africans from all the continent of the African Union. When the ANC broke the mold, the mold for the Organization of African Unity from its existence in 1963 until it became the African Union in 2001 or whenever it was always that never would a regional hegemon ever lead the administration portion of the African Union or be the chairman of the African Union. Never going to happen. Guess what? In order to get rid of NDZ, they pushed, and South Africa broke that mold, and they went up there. And I can tell you the least popular person in Addis Ababa when I lived there wasn't me. It was Nkosi Zanani Dalemizuma. She had no friends. Nobody talked to her. And she rarely left her office.
Just like Trudeau at one of those United Nations meetings. He wanted to shake hands. And nobody wanted to shake hands.
Exactly. So, yeah, she was very unpopular. And that still angers a lot of African countries about the ANC threw its weight around. Because that had never been done before. Algeria had never led the AU or the OAU. Egypt had never led it. Nigeria had never led it. It's like Burkina Faso, Gabon, Niger, countries like that. But the South Africans threw their weight around, and that kind of irritated a lot of people. So I would hope, and I think that it's unlikely we'll have a nuclear conflict, but I don't discount it entirely.
What happened to our nukes, six of them? We had six.
Oh, I got them on sale from Take-A-Lot. I did! They were dismantled. They were totally dismantled. This is public knowledge, but it's true story. They were, as far as I know,
so
public.
They didn't actually leave the country.
No, they were taken apart here and dismantled the parts so they couldn't be reconnected. Yeah, before they fell into the hands of the ANC.
We got a question here.
Douglas,
you were involved. Would you like to answer that
question? Well, as the colonel has rightly said, and I have to say, the colonel is perhaps one of the best informed people I have ever met. South Africa. Never mind America, but on South Africa, what you've shared with us tonight is incredible.
Yeah.
And there are only a handful of South Africans who could try to compete with you in terms of your knowledge, the extent of your analysis, and the depth of your understanding of what's happening in this country.
Yeah.
To hear what you had to say about the rest of Africa was riveting. Your take on the United States gave one great hope
that if there were more men and women of your caliber, then the great United States, you can put the great back in again, just as Mr. Trump has been saying. But to answer your question to you, we dismantled the lot under international supervision.
Yep.
The British came out, they took a look at the rocket range, and we didn't even tell them what it was for, and they said, my goodness, you people are capable of putting a nuclear bomb anywhere in the world.
Yep.
The French came out, and the French colonel walked around, and he said, sacre bleu, sacre bleu. He said, You can put a 24 kiloton nuclear bomb anywhere in the world with error point of 500 meters. And we hadn't told him that. He worked it out.
Based on what he saw.
Based on what he saw.
And he that was true.
Absolutely right. They were both, the Brits and the French are absolutely right. And the irony, Colonel, is that to do that, we use the United States telephone satellite system as the guidance system.
I can neither confirm nor deny that story. But it's
so
true.
I think that answers your question.
It's amazing.
Well, thank you for the kind compliments. Very generous of you. I appreciate it.
It's been
incredible.
Thank you. Yeah, all night.
It's incredible.
Yeah, really.
If I'm welcome to come back, the next trip, I'm happy to come back and speak again. So.
It is amazing.